Desafinado Discord, the theme music for Literary Discord, my monthly program about books and book publishing. I am Hans Koning. Today you get to hear Roxanne Cody. Roxanne Cody is the owner of a very remarkable bookstore. It's in Madison, Connecticut. It's 2 or 3 hours away from New York, depending on the traffic. But somehow, even in New York, people know about it. She has somehow managed to give this independent bookstore a face, and she seems to be bucking the trend which predicts that independent bookstores are on the way out. Here's Roxanne Cody, owner of the R.J. Julia Bookstore in Madison, Connecticut. Roxanne, begin by sketching the present situation in which a bookstore like yours finds itself. How does it survive? How does it react to the change? And how does it react to the Amazon and the Internet? And how does it react to the general change in book publishing?
Great. You'd like me to do this in under 2 hours, I take it. Stores like ours that have done better than most independents have both sort of good and bad news. The good news is that we love what we do and that we have any number of customers who love what we do. The challenge for us is that we are dealing, at least for now, with competitors that have huge access to capital, which means that they're able to compete with us in a way that feels imbalanced. For instance, Amazon can afford to sell books at a discount because the market hasn't yet made them make a profit. So we're competing. I can't afford to lose 80 million or whatever sort of huge number they lose on a quarterly basis, because for us it's real money. Money I'd have to pay back to the bank, not stock market money that can be used at will. So that makes it very difficult for us to explain to people who say, well, how come Amazon can sell it for 30% off and you can't? The other side, which is the chains, which is actually a more challenging problem in two regards. One is, the chains have, in some ways, taken credit for democratizing bookselling. You know, that they've made bookselling available to the public who might have felt intimidated by independent bookstores. But in point of fact, that's not true, because if you look at the statistics, they have not net increased the sale of books. It's what I call shifting in the sand. They tend to take business away from independents or other sources that people have been getting their books. But what they do, which I find trickier to compete with, is they give the impression that they're discounting more than they in fact discount. So for instance, we give 10% off in our store to everyone who's in the book club. It costs us an enormous amount of money. And if I said to you, we actually discount more than some of the chains, you, like many people, might say, oh, I find that hard to believe. But in fact, what the chains now do is discount only two things. They discount at about 10 or 15 bestsellers, hardcover and paperback, but they run huge advertising campaigns, full page in the New York Times, full page in the New Yorker, listing books that they're discounting. And in fact, those ads are paid for by the publishers for the most part. You know, they use what's called co-op money. But and those books are discounted, but that gives the impression that everything's discounted. And in point of fact, most everything in the store is not discounted. What they do sometimes is they'll go into a community where they have a lot of competition and will introduce a lot of discounts. But once the competitors are gone, they tend to roll the discounts back. So the challenge for a store like ours is to not try to compete on price and compete based on what we do well, that we have discernment, that we have good judgment about the books, that we work really hard to train our staff to be knowledgeable. And above and beyond anything, we work really hard to meet our customers' needs and figure out what it is. And even if we're not smart enough to know every book that might be helpful to them, we are earnest, if not hell-bent, on really trying to help that customer find the right book for themselves, for their child, for a gift. And the hope is that that is compelling enough to our customers for us to keep enough business.
Well, this touches one of the things I've been talking about already on this program, which is the fixed price thing.
Yes.
Which in Europe is a big discussion, as you know, of course. In France, the fixed price people have just won again. They had abolished it for a while, and it is back. I read somewhere in a French paper. The idea being that you have to sell a book within 5% of the price on the jacket.
Right.
So, indeed, from your experience, that would be a crucial thing for small bookstores to survive.
Well, the other way in which it's looked at, it's called net pricing, meaning that there wouldn't be any price on the book. I actually think having a price on the book hurts us because the price clubs and Barnes & Noble and everyone else are often using the book as a loss leader in order to create the impression that they're discounting everything. So, for instance, the price club right in the front of the store has their bestsellers off 40 or 50%. The idea of that is they don't care about whether they sell the books. They're barely making any money on them. But subliminally, that's telling you that their tires are 40% off and their air conditioners are 40% off. And I wonder if we wouldn't be better off if the price weren't on the book so that they wouldn't have anything to say that it's off. I think that we give too much to the rest of the market by having the price on the book. But this is a little bit off the subject, but one of the things that I always find amusing, I was an accountant before I was a bookseller, is in no other business does the price go down when the demand goes up. I mean, what kind of business is this that, you know, the minute it's a bestseller, it's discounted?
Well, but a book gets cheaper the more copies you print, no?
But that's not actually what's motivating it. It's some sort of quirk that started in this business. It's not necessarily that the costs have come down, you know, that there's an economy of scale. It's that it's a bestseller. Now, think about how ironic in any other industry, when the demand increases, they certainly wouldn't lower the price. They would raise the price. In this business, they lower the price.
Can I say that it's almost inconceivable in the present, in the philosophy, economic philosophy of the United States, that a fixed price could be law, that you would have to sell a book? Do you think that's... Well,
inconceivable to me. Yeah. It's inconceivable in this environment, in this country, that would ever achieve any kind of broad-based support.
So, leaving that aside then, indeed, it seems... almost impossible to achieve that. If there was no price given, then you would at least, that would be a very tricky business for you to then price it. You would at least have to publish what you pay the publisher per copy.
Yeah, but what there would be is there would be the opportunity to make money on certain things and less on others. Right now, let's say I find a book that no one else has found that I think is particularly appealing, that I can buy at a very low cost or print at a very low cost. The idea that I could price it, most of the market prices things in a way that allows them the opportunity to enjoy a certain profit level. That does not exist in the book business now. And so we have a double challenge. We have a challenge in that there's a modest profit margin to be made. And coupled with the challenge that we're competing with companies that have cheap or free capital. So that, for instance, I can understand how I could expand my business in a way that I would be excited about if I had patient capital, meaning money that I could invest in my business that I didn't have to worry about paying the interest cost or repaying the loan until I grew the business enough to repay it.
Do you own this store, actually, this building?
I do. I own the store, and I own the building. And the fact that I own the building allows me to at least sleep between midnight and 2 a.m., where I'm not worrying about, you know, many independents have struggled, that they're in a community, it's become prosperous and successful, and then their rent. I was talking to someone the other day, a bookstore in Texas closed. Their rent doubled. You know, there's no conceivable way that a bookstore can absorb those kind of increases, because the other thing, which is nice for the most part about a strong economy, is that we have a real pressure on the wages that we pay. And we want to be able to pay fair wages. So if you think about the double squeeze of a fixed price, sort of a modest margin with increased labor costs and increased rent. I know I sound whiny. I don't mean to.
No, you sound very matter of fact. Well, looking at the other side, I've always felt myself or learned, and various guests on this program have confirmed, that the traditional publisher was happy with his job, with his work, and didn't expect more than, say, 5% profit, and that the new guys from the big corporations who also sell washing machines or missiles or God knows what else, they want as much profit as they could get on the stock market, so they're thinking of 15 or 20%, or they won't even bother. And that must have an enormous influence on the kind of books that you actually end up in your store.
Well, you know what? It has not impacted the books that are in the store. I would have to say that, I'll come back to the first part of your comment, but in terms of the books being published, the quality of books being published and the availability is fantastic. Fantastic. So that what's trickier is I pick the books. I can pick the books that are in the store. I feel like it's my job to be the eyes and ears for our customers, so that I go through the 50,000 books a year that are published, and I choose those that I think have merit, that will be of interest. I also carry the books that are commercially in demand. I'm not silly about it, but the books are available. The publisher's need to create a profit has not yet impacted the number of titles being published, nor the availability of quality titles. That's not been the problem. That's not been to my experience.
That's an amazingly optimistic statement from my point of view. I haven't heard that. I mean, in general, we all agree that really serious books are virtually unpublishable. Anna Schifrin, the last person on this program, said you just waste your time if you send a serious novel to one of the big houses.
Well, I think that there's a difference between the percent of books that might be published that would be worthwhile and that declining as against the absolute number of books. I think that many good quality serious fiction and nonfiction books are in fact getting through the net or over the wall. I think what is frustrating is it is more difficult to get those books published. So that, I'm making these numbers up, I don't, you know, but to make the point, it might very well be that at one point there were 500 fabulous books trying to get published and 100 got published. And now there are 1,000 trying to get published and there are still only 100 being published. But we still have those 100, but I think the percent of what could be done is a lower percent because more of the space is being taken up by the commercial books. But the absolute number of them, I don't think, has declined.
I think we agree on the fact there is so much noise in the marketplace. I mean, there's such clamor, full-page ad for books, which in my experience was unheard of 20 years ago, that in order to get the serious books to the attention of the public, you have to do fantastic tricks, really. Because the publishers in general, the big ones, after a few weeks even, I think, they sort of know which are the ones that can be made, bombarded into bestsellers, or at least in large sellers, and the rest, it just falls by the wayside. So I would think that if you pick quality books, you'll have a hard time finding a customer who's even heard of them.
Well, I think that is the challenge. And in fact, this Authors Guild report that came out, that was written by David Kirkpatrick, and was discussed at an Authors Guild panel chaired by Nick Lehman. His report showed two facts that confirm exactly what you're what we're both saying. One is the number of what's referred to as midlist titles has not declined, meaning non-bestsellers. But what has happened is the noise is so loud and so clamoring that the opportunity to get someone's attention for a small title becomes that much more challenging. But it's why I think bookstores like ours continue to have a place in the world, because that's our job. What I sometimes wonder about recently is whether bookstores like theater companies and dance companies ought to be nonprofit institutions, that their job has a kind of a nonprofit goal, and it can't necessarily be accomplished in a commercial way.
Starting really from the beginning, well, first of all, who is R.J. Julia?
R.J. Julia is sort of a conglomeration. Julia is my grandmother, who was Hungarian, lived in Hungary and died in Bergen-Belsen. And she was a very feisty, strong woman who felt very strongly about education. I never met her, but I have always been enamored of the sense of her. And so the store Julia, Juliska in Hungarian, is in her honor. And R is Roxanne, and J is Joseph, my husband Kevin's middle name. And the reason it's not R.K. Julia is that sounded like a studio, a movie studio. And R.J. Julia just sounded better. So it's my name, my husband's, and my grandmother's.
I see. And you exist 10 years right now.
10 years.
Now, take us from the beginning. How, because there is something special about the store, obviously, because when I lived not so far from you now, but even when I lived in New York, we knew of this store, which is really 2 hours away. Tell us how you succeeded, as a lesson perhaps for some other bookstore owners in the country, how you made this into a store with a name and a face.
I think that there were a number of things. One was, when I started the store, my prime objective was that this would be a place for conversation, that I have felt that people's opportunity to converse in a meaningful way has sort of disappeared. There isn't the gathering, there isn't the town square, there isn't the opportunity to have conversation. And that if I could bring authors here and introduce the possibility of people having conversation, that I would feel that we had accomplished something, and that it would give people a place, and I mean that like capital P, that it would be a place that mattered. And that was a clear purpose. And even early on, when we didn't have a reputation with the publishers, if we couldn't get the author, we'd discuss it anyway. So, for instance, when Backlash came out by Susan Faludi, we couldn't get Susan Faludi at the time, but I put up a sign and said, would you like to talk about it? And I asked Faith Middleton to come, and Gina Barreca, who's a feminist literature professor up at UConn. We had 102 women who just wanted to talk about it. People want to have the opportunity in a serious way to converse about things. Now, we're very fortunate because we're so grateful to authors who come here. We take good care of them. We now have 2 to 4 events a week and have anywhere from 5 people to 1,000 people. And some of the conversations with 5 people are just as meaningful to us as 1,000 people.
How large a pool of potential customers do you have?
Well, I consider the state to be the area that we might draw from. But in terms of our customers that come here with some regularity, we have about 25,000 total customers, and we have about 6,000 very good customers. The other thing that I should mention, which is a not so funny joke, is the other thing I say about the book business is the way to make a small fortune in the book business is to start with a large fortune. And partially, I was lucky. We had moved from New York, where I had had a successful career in the financial world, and wanted to make a meaningful investment and commitment to the store, and that's what I did. So that the other thing that added I think, to our success is it's a beautiful store. The space is attractive. We had nice bags and good. And the other part of what we did was we always had a newsletter, so that we could inform people about books that they might not otherwise hear about.
Can we just walk through the store and you point out how it is set up and how what leads to what?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. We are at the door of Main Street, Madison. How many people are in Madison? Do you have any idea?
About 14,000.
So you go way beyond the town,
obviously. Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we come in and see what we see.
On the right, as we come in the door, which is something very exciting, it's called BookSense, which is a program that was put together by the American Booksellers Association, and it goes right to what we were talking about. In an attempt to have the independent booksellers in the country aggregate their opinions, there are now 76 titles picked every 2 months from independents all over the country, and it's called the BookSense 76, so that here we have a pamphlet with the 76 titles that have been picked by different independents, and some of the books that are the most interesting that we've chosen to let our customers know about books that they might not hear about. The other thing that's very cool about this program is we've started these BookSense gift certificates, so that if you have a daughter in California but you live here in Madison, you could buy a BookSense gift certificate that's redeemable at 1,200 independents across the country. So you could go to Elliott Bay in Seattle, or Dutton's in Los Angeles, or the Bookstall in Chicago.
Is there an overlap in titles with the bestseller list?
There conceivably could be. I mean, they're really based on the books that I'm trying to think. Well, for instance, Margaret Atwood's The Blind Assassin is here, and I'm not sure that it's on the bestseller list, but
it's might
be.
It's a name, anyway.
Yeah. Nancy Taylor Rosenberg, who writes a lot of well-known mysteries, could be on the bestseller list, but it would be a coincidence. In other words,
Who specifically has picked these titles?
Actually, booksellers in all the stores. So, for instance, if we looked at this brochure, you would see that Black Mass was chosen by Elliot Tisdale at Davis Kidd in Nashville, Tennessee, or Nancy Olson in Quail Ridge, Raleigh, North Carolina, has picked No Great Mischief by Alastair MacLeod. And so it's literally different booksellers in various parts of the country who nominated these books. And if there are enough nominations, they're added to the list. So they really are hand-picked books. And what's exciting is that's the reverse of what we think about is what the independents have been able to do collectively is put books on the bestseller list. And it's kind of showing the kind of impact that we can have on the market, so that you could end up with the kinds of books that you'd never dream of being on the bestseller list, achieving that kind of word of mouth and therefore sales, and they're books that are phenomenal. You know, that's what happened with Cold Mountain.
Right. Okay, let's walk on.
Okay.
Let's go in.
So, over here we have our New England section, right, which is obvious for what it is. Now, here what we have are the new books. These are the new fiction books. These are the new nonfiction books that we think are the most interesting books coming out. And these range from books that we think people will want to know about, that are bestseller type books like Tom Clancy, or they're books like Martha Peake, which is by Patrick McGrath, that is this incredibly new, wonderful, gothic, lush novel that's out, and we adore him. So,
which revolution is that?
The American Revolution.
I see. What is this here, this card?
These are what we call shelf talkers. And
All these books have...
And this,
are they written by your own people?
They're written by our staff, and it's actually the thing that people talk the most about loving about our store, because, again, 50,000 books are published. And how on earth do you pick what appeals to you? So people over the years, this is another thing that we started right from the beginning. So we call these shelf talkers. So these are little reviews by different members of our staff. And two things happen. One is people come to know which bookseller they tend to agree with. you know, that they like what Mary has to say, that they don't like what I have to say, and they love what Suzanne has to say. But what they know is, they know that this is honest, and they know that if we're saying it, it's because we're excited about the book in some way. And customers have really come to rely on this. It's the first place they stop in the store. And we have one for hardcovers, and it covers fiction and nonfiction, and then we have one over here for paperbacks.
Oh, this is terrific. I've never seen this.
Yeah, people love it.
Yeah.
And it's reliable.
Read this one.
Okay, so for instance, this is a fabulous read, suspense, intrigue, craziness, and it's all true. It may make you angry, but you can't put it down. Or Shana has written a review of Ishiguro's new book. He's the man who wrote Remains of the Dead.
Right.
He has written this new and compelling novel, Detective Christopher Banks Returns to Shanghai to Uncover the Truth Behind the Mysterious Disappearance of His Parents 30 Years Earlier.
We are a long way here from from what happened to me in a big bookstore, which I shan't name, where I asked for a book by Oscar Wilde, and the salesperson said, no, we don't have that, but we have something by Thornton Wilder.
So here are two sections that you don't often find as a prominent item in bookstores, but there are two sections that we're particularly fond of. One is short stories, which we're big fans of, and the other is poetry.
Right.
And I really feel that people stay away from poetry because they think they're supposed to understand it in a way that is more intellectual than they might be capable of. And I don't think that's true. I think it's just, I think short stories and poetry are a great way to dip into literature if you're short time, which people often say they are.
On we go.
So these are staff suggestions for mass market. So we have hardcover, what's called trade paper, and then paperback books. Here's the young adult section, and we feel this is a particular challenge because today, for all the obvious reasons, when a young person reads young adultdom, books are competing with a lot of other forms of entertainment. So we try to have a number of the young people who work in the store read these books so that we really know what will appeal to them, not what we think will appeal to them, because as a 51-year-old woman, what do I know, really, about today's 14-year-old? And this has worked really well because they pick out books that, you know, like this book Smack, that Morgan read, who's a high school. Smack is a wonderful novel which tells of the horrors of drug abuse and what can happen when it gets serious. Families destroyed, loved ones lost, and tremendous emotional damage. Now, I might have read this and thought it was too dark or wouldn't be acceptable, but Morgan, who's 17 years old, read it and thought that they spoke about drug abuse in a way that a young person would in fact relate to. So this is a big deal to us, and one of the things that we're going to try to do is next spring is set up a part of the store that's just for young adults with their own seating and their own books for them to feel like this is a place for them too.
You very much depend on the kind of staff you have to make this a success, I gather.
We do, and we've been very lucky.
Where did they come from?
Well, they
did you train them?
We train them, but they come with a love of books.
Right. You have listened to Roxanne Cody and me. Roxanne Cody is the owner of the R.J. Julia bookstore in Madison, Connecticut. Curiously enough, just at the time we did this program, the New York Times carried a report about how the discount policies for bestsellers, about which Roxanne Cody speaks, threatens to go into abeyance because it costs them too much money, and predicts that the entire discount policy of book chains and internet providers will presently vanish from the scene. If that's true, of course, there's a major revision of what's happening in publishing, as far as I can tell at this point, a very good one for serious literature. You have listened to Literary Discord. Thank you. We hope that you will be back when we are back. It's the fourth Thursday of November, Thanksgiving Day, actually. And we will be there all the same with news from publishing and books. I am Hans Corning, and my producer is Scott Harris.